KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. Iran has exercised tremendous influence in the Middle East. What does this mean for the region now that many of its allies have fallen and Israel is expanding its war against it? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. ...80,000 veterans are behind on their mortgages. The VA used to have a program to help them, but it shut down last month. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadil. We'll hear from some of the vets who've been left stranded and could lose their homes. Also, what director Danny Boyle learned from COVID that inspired his latest horror movie 28 years later. It's Friday, June 20th. On this day in 1782, the Continental Congress agreed on a design for the Great Seal of the United States, an eagle with arrows in one talon and an olive branch in the other. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. President Trump continues to weigh whether the U.S. will enter the war between Israel and Iran. The White House says he'll make the decision within the next 2 weeks. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf reports the U.S. possesses a bomb that is thought to be capable of reaching even Iran's most well-protected nuclear facility.
The most fortified nuclear facility in Iran is called Fordo, located deep inside a mountain. And the U.S. has the only bomb that could damage it. Because of its size, that 30,000-pound bomb can only be carried by a B-2 stealth bomber, also something only the U.S. has. Most experts agree that the bomb could cause serious, possibly even debilitating damage to the facility, although it could take several hits. The real question is whether that would stop Iran's nuclear program or simply put it on hold, as Iran would still have the scientists and knowledge to start it back up again. Meanwhile, the International Atomic Energy Agency has warned such an attack could cause radioactive contamination. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Washington.
A dangerous heat wave is building across the central U.S., with temperatures expected to reach the triple digits in parts of the plains today. Brian Jackson is a meteorologist with the National Weather Service. He says some areas could break records as the heat wave stretches into next week.
It'll really encompass the whole eastern United States. And with that, you know, this is what we consider a heat dome, and it's going to become pretty stationary. So Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday next week, it's really going to be the same type of weather with increasing heat through that time.
Officials are urging people to stay hydrated and limit outdoor activities. Cooling centers are open in several cities. ICE immigration raids have continued at a number of Home Depots and some car washes in Los Angeles. Steve Futterman reports the Los Angeles Dodgers say agents who showed up at their stadium on Thursday were turned away.
In a social media post, the LA Dodgers say ICE agents came to the stadium and requested permission to access the parking lots. The Dodgers say they were denied entry. The team did not indicate why ICE might have wanted to enter the parking areas. DHS responded saying, quote, this had nothing to do with the Dodgers. The agency's post says that Customs and Border Protection vehicles were in the parking lot briefly, quote, unrelated to any operation or enforcement. The Dodgers have come under criticism by some fans for essentially saying nothing last week about the ICE operations and protests in L.A. For NPR News, I'm Steve Futterman in Los Angeles.
Stocks close mixed across Asia today. On Wall Street, Dow futures are trading higher at this hour. This is NPR News in Washington. A panel of federal judges in California has ruled that President Trump can retain control of the state's National Guard. Governor Gavin Newsom had filed a lawsuit arguing the president exceeded his authority. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that Trump acted within his power amid immigration protests in the city. The state can still challenge the use of National Guard and U.S. Marines under other laws, including the bar on using troops in domestic law enforcement. Goliath the tortoise had a big celebration on Sunday as he marked his first Father's Day. NPR's Ayanna Archie reports he also turned 135 years old at a zoo in Miami.
Goliath's hatchling was born in early June after incubating for about 4 months. It is the first Galapagos tortoise hatchling born at Zoo Miami. Goliath had been matched with several female tortoises to breed, but the process had been unsuccessful, until he mated with Sweet Pea. The zoo has submitted applications to the Guinness Book of World Records to consider Goliath for the title of oldest first-time father in history. Ayanna Archie, NPR News.
Hurricane Eric has made landfall along Mexico's Pacific coast, bringing destructive winds, torrential rain, and dangerous surf. The Category 3 storm hit early this morning. It has since weakened to a post-tropical cyclone. Forecasters are warning of life-threatening floods, mudslides, with some areas expecting a storm total of 16 inches of rain. Thousands of customers remain without power. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, dedicated to improving the learning experience for America's students by sharing what works in pre-K through 12 education at edutopia.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. President Trump says he is still making up his mind on whether to strike targets inside Iran. Meanwhile, Europe is trying for diplomacy as Israel and Iran enter their second week of war.
European diplomats are meeting Iran's foreign minister in Geneva today, while Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu suggested Israel will continue attacking Iran's nuclear sites, even if President Trump decides not to take part. An Iranian human rights group says more than 650 people in Iran have been killed by Israeli strikes. And Israel says Iranian missiles have killed 24 people in Israel.
We have NPR's Daniel Estrin on the line with us now from Tel Aviv to tell us more. Good morning, Daniel.
Good morning, Michelle.
Okay, so this started a week ago when Israel launched these strikes against the nuclear sites and against military officials and nuclear scientists. And now, of course, Iran has responded. And as we've just heard, there have been fatalities on both sides. Now, Prime Minister Netanyahu gave a rationale for this when it first started. Has he said any more about why he chose this moment?
He was asked that question again yesterday on Israeli public broadcasting, and he did say more. He said this all goes back to September when Israel assassinated Hassan Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah in Lebanon. He was the head of Iran's main proxy in the region, and Netanyahu said that when Nasrallah was killed and Hezbollah largely collapsed, Iran rushed to try to create a nuclear bomb, and Netanyahu claimed Iran was less than a year away, though there have been debates and differing U.S. intelligence assessments on that. But analysts in Israel say other political factors are at play here. Netanyahu was under intense domestic pressure to end the Gaza war, to get Israeli hostages back. His government barely survived a no-confidence vote in parliament, and then a day later, he launched the Iran attack, and that gave Netanyahu a major political comeback. The majority of Israelis support the attacks on Iran.
So what more can you tell us about diplomatic efforts now?
Iran's state media says Iran's foreign minister is meeting with his counterparts from France, Germany, and the UK today in Geneva. The British foreign minister met Secretary of State Marco Rubio yesterday and said there was a two-week window for a diplomatic solution. And remember, yesterday the White House said Trump would make a decision within 2 weeks whether to strike Iran. European diplomats have been calling for restraint, but also have said Israel has the right to protect its security and its people. And Israel sees that as Europe actually supporting its attacks on Iran's nuclear sites, which is very different from Europe's explicit calls for Israel to end the Gaza war.
So, Daniel, does Israel need the U.S. to achieve its goal of destroying Iran's nuclear program?
Well, Netanyahu was asked that question on Israeli TV yesterday, and he said, "We will achieve all our goals, all their nuclear facilities. It's in our power to do so." And he said it was up to Trump to decide whether to join in. I spoke to a person familiar with the matter who spoke on condition of anonymity because of the sensitivity of the issue, who told me Israeli officials believe Israel can destroy Iran's most fortified nuclear site, Fordo, on its own without the U.S. bombing it, but that it would just be quicker if the U.S. took part. Experts tell NPR U.S. bunker-busting bombs could do serious damage to the Fordo site, but that wouldn't destroy Iran's know-how to actually build nuclear weapons in the future.
That is NPR's Daniel Estrin in Tel Aviv. Daniel, thank you.
You're welcome.
What happens in this war between Israel and Iran will have major repercussions for the entire Middle East. For years, Iran commanded huge influence throughout the region by way of militias and forces they funded and armed in Lebanon, Syria, Gaza, Yemen, and Iraq. Israel has spent the last couple of years attacking and weakening those groups, and now it's turned its weaponry and attention directly to Iran. So how is this war being received in the region? To understand that, we're joined by journalist Kim Ratas. She has covered the Middle East for decades and is the author of the book Black Wave, which chronicles the long rivalry between Iran and Saudi Arabia. She joins us on the line from Beirut. Good morning, Kim.
Great to be with you, Leila. Good morning.
Thank you for being here. Now, Kim, we haven't seen a major reaction from Iran's allies or proxies, I assume in part because they're not capable or fully gone, like Bashar al-Assad in Syria. You're in Lebanon. Where is Hezbollah in all this, one of Iran's most powerful proxies until it was severely decimated by Israeli attacks in the past year?
As you say, Leila, Hezbollah has been severely incapacitated by Israeli attacks last year, attacks which continue to this day. There are still regular strikes, Israeli strikes against southern Lebanon, the eastern Bekaa Valley, and just 2 weeks ago, one in Beirut. I think Hezbollah is wary of getting involved because it knows that the Israeli reaction will be devastating for Lebanon. It's been made very clear to Hezbollah that they should stay out of it. That's been the message from U.S. officials who visited Lebanon, from the Lebanese government as well, and the Lebanese president. And their way of saving face for Hezbollah after all this time saying that they're, you know, the vanguard of defending Iran is to say Iran doesn't need our help at the moment. And indeed, you could argue that Iran's missiles are doing enough damage in Israel as it is.
Where do other countries stand in this conflict, and what do they want to see happen? I'm thinking of Jordan, the Gulf states, Saudi Arabia, which is also a regional powerhouse.
Everyone is very worried about the fact that Benjamin Netanyahu knows how to start wars, doesn't have a plan for how they end, nor for the day after, and we've seen that with Gaza. And they've become very frustrated, particularly countries like the UAE and Saudi Arabia, who've constantly extended their hand to Israel. The UAE has the Abraham Accords with Israel. They're frustrated by Benjamin Netanyahu's repeated, continuous efforts to violently reshape the region. Obviously, they have no real love lost for Iran.
Right.
They're probably quietly satisfied that its military commanders, ballistic missiles, nuclear program is taking a hit. But they're also incredibly worried about the chaos this could provoke in the region and the fact, as I said, that Bibi doesn't have a plan for the day after. I think they're also surprised by President Trump's decision to go along with Benjamin Netanyahu, either for a while already or in the last week before the strike started, because that was not the mood barely a few weeks ago when President Trump visited Saudi Arabia, and all the talk was about, you know, building hotels and, you know, doing business deals. They did not want this war, and they're certainly working the phones very hard to make that message, make that case to President Trump.
I mean, as you point out, there's no love lost between Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Iran, but you say they fear this deep destabilization and violence. Are there hopes in these European talks with Iran? Is this something regional leaders support?
Regional leaders absolutely support negotiations. They want this campaign to come to a close fairly soon. Again, keeping in consideration sort of the pragmatic look at the positives of such a decapitation campaign against Iran's, you know, military capabilities, but it needs to wrap up. And I'm being, you know, very pragmatic, and we must point out that civilians are dying in Iran as well. Israeli strikes are not only going against military or nuclear targets, but they're also worried about being collateral damage. If this goes on for too long, Iran could potentially, as a last resort, lash out against U.S. military forces in the region, and those are positioned in Gulf countries all around the region.
Kim Ghattas is a journalist, a contributing writer to the Financial Times, and she joined us from Beirut. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
We've been reaching out to people in Iran and Israel for their thoughts about the war. We start with Bahran, a 21-year-old university student from Tehran. We're only using her first name due to a fear of government retribution.
You can hear sounds of drones, air defense explosions, broadcasts breaking news covering an area that's under attack. It seems like when the air defenses fail, the bombs hit and we hear them.
Vanessa Kacherginsky lives in a suburb of Tel Aviv with her husband and three children. Rockets have landed near their home.
We really felt, you know, our body jumped from the floor. You could really hear it. You could really feel it.
Soon after Israel's strike started, Bahran and her family in Iran packed a few belongings and left their home.
Why are we leaving? These belongings are all ours. We worked hard for them. We're in love with this place. We grew up in this place. Where are we supposed to go? Even talking about it makes me cry.
Mahaya Leshem lives in northern Israel with his wife and three kids. After the October 7th attack by Hamas, they feared an invasion in the north and left their home for a few months.
Children in Israel and in the region altogether, I mean, in other countries as well. But as the wars have been going on, they've had no normal life in the last, you know, from COVID, it feels like things never went back to any kind of normality.
Kourosh is from Tehran. Again, we're only using his first name out of concern for government retribution for speaking. He has this to say about the future.
My hope is that this regime's fate is decided as soon as possible. Hopefully Trump will get involved and help overthrow this regime.
Yashmin Schwartz is a teacher living outside of Haifa who says Israelis have positive feelings about the Iranian people.
It's like kind of the dream of Israelis that one day Iranians and Israelis can go back to being friends like it was before the Islamic Republic took over. You know, there used to be flights between Tehran and Tel Aviv.
Our conversation with Yashmin was cut short due to a warning siren.
We're getting a warning that there's going to be an air raid siren soon. So I have to go. I'm sorry.
In Iran, Bahran also cut her conversation short. The government, she said, was going to impose an internet blackout.
So I think I won't be available for a while and say anything more. Take care and goodbye.
Voices from inside Iran and Israel. Two longtime arrivals now at war. This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, we remember Edmund White, one of the most eloquent and perceptive chroniclers of gay life and culture, beginning in the 1960s. He wrote over 30 books of fiction, nonfiction, and essays. The first of his trilogy of semi-autobiographical novels, A Boy's Own Story, was an international bestseller. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Dickinson College, awarding the Rose Walters Prize for Global Environmental Activism to combat climate change and inspire future leaders. Learn more at dickinson.edu/RWP. From Melville Charitable Trust, committed to ensuring all people have a safe, stable, and affordable home that allows them to thrive. Information about ways to prevent and solve homelessness is at melvilletrust.org. From EBSCO, committed to providing colleges and universities with relevant online research databases to ensure student, faculty, and staff success. Learn more at EBSCO.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel. First, there was the post-apocalyptic horror movie 28 Days Later. Then, 28 Weeks Later. The latest in the franchise, 28 Years Later, opens, as you might guess, nearly three decades after a zombie virus escaped from a medical research lab in the UK, and it is terrifying.
There were so many dead. Infected and non-infected alike.
Our colleague A. Martinez sat down with director Danny Boyle to discuss the new film. Boyle said he wasn't aware how much people loved 28 Days Later until he went to a 20th anniversary screening back in 2022.
There wasn't any sense of, you know, watching an old classic or, something that they remembered with nostalgia. It felt urgent. And 28 years later, which is obviously convenient in terms of the identity of the project yeah. and its connection to the originals, did give us the chance to start afresh with a whole swathe of new characters and a ground zero effect of you looking at how have they rebuilt their lives, if there are any survivors, and how has the virus changed? How has the virus evolved?
By then, so we're about 2 years into the COVID pandemic in 2022. So how did that influence the making of 28 Years Later?
It was obviously a reminder in real life of how cities can change their identity overnight in an unimaginable way, in a way that you can only ever figure happened in movies and did used to happen in movies like our movie. But it was more helpful for us about what happened in the year that followed. Our behavior changes after that initial alert, utter alarm of danger. Humans don't sustain that. You relax and you begin to take slightly more risks and then slightly more risks, and you just begin to find out how you can live within this emergency. And for us, 28 years means that, for instance, in the film, he takes his son to the mainland, his 12-year-old son to the mainland. If it was 28 days later, he would never.
Oh, never. Not a million years, right?
Yeah. But the fact that it's 28 years later, he does. He's still a 12-year-old boy going to a very dangerous place. But humans do this. They've learned how to manage the risk.
So you mentioned a father, Jamie, and he takes his 12-year-old son, Spike, to the mainland. That's where the infected are. And the people in this film live on an island that's connected to the mainland by a causeway that's accessed by a low tide. So why does Jamie take Spike to the infected area?
He's doing his duty in terms of the way the culture of the island exists. He's doing his duty in teaching his son his role, what his role will be, which is the same as his father's role, which is to learn how to protect those who need to go to the island. So it's actually, it's tough love. It's hard, but he's got to learn it.
Yeah, a rite of passage, right?
Yeah, yeah, a rites of passage, and it's very traditional.
It's clear. Let's go. Get back to the trees.
It's only in the second half of the film, where he comes under the influence of his mother, that you realize the boy is gaining something different, which more fully makes him an adult, which is he learns something quieter and more compassionate and emotional, and makes him a more fully rounded figure, I think.
You know, when I look in your face, see your granddad's eyes, it's nice. Exactly.
You should get some sleep. I'm gonna stay awake. Need watch. Okay, Dad.
Now, 28 days later made fast-moving zombies a thing. 28 years later, the zombies get upgrades. Can you tell us a little bit about what people will expect to see with these zombies in 28 years later?
Well, of course, the fascinating thing for us was that the United Nations or NATO or the EU have isolated this island. And I think in their imagination is that the infection will burn itself out one day and they'd be able to repopulate the island if they needed to. And they think that because the way it presents itself, the infection is hugely, is frenzied. It is enormously energy consuming. So the only way it can survive is they have to learn to drink and to eat. And of course, if you don't have weapons, the only way you can eat is by being organized like a pack of dogs. And then that throws up a leader. A dominant will emerge, an alpha will emerge out of that. So there was that. And then those who can't hunt, they go to ground because there are different ways of surviving. And so there's a pack that go to the ground and just eat berries and worms and snails and bugs and whatever they can find. So there's an evolutionary, albeit 28 years is probably a short time for the evolutionary process. The virus has learned how to survive. It's effectively mutated, as we know COVID did.
Now, Danny, with this next question, I'm going to try my best to dance on the line of spoilers, because this is my favorite scene in the whole movie, and I can't go without asking you about it. Because Spike's mom, Isla, is having bad memory loss problems, has no idea what's causing it. Once Spike finds out about this, that there's a doctor on the mainland, he takes her to him out of desperation. So there, they come up in an abandoned train car to an infected who is pregnant and is about to give birth. But despite their mutual fear of each other, their instincts as mothers take over. They both remember their humanity. Despite the infected's rage and Isla's fear of her, to me, that is the most hopeful part of this entire film, in that humanity still can win out.
Yes, and that's the purpose of that. There's something deeper. The virus doesn't create monsters. It creates very dangerous people. But they are still us, and that will be a source of investigation for the rest of the trilogy. We're hoping to make three films. We've made two, and we're hoping to raise the money to make a third. And that's the basis for that investigation. But you're right. The premise is that deeper than the infection can reach, there is a humanity there.
Danny Boyle directs the new film, 28 years later. Danny, thank you very much for the time.
Magic. Thanks very much. Cheers now.
This is NPR News.
Ongoing ICE raids have led to a massive slump for businesses in Latino neighborhoods of Los Angeles.
Our community is genuinely scared to leave their homes at moments, and many of the vendors here are also afraid to open shop.
We take you to a beloved Mexican market, El Mercadito, to hear how business owners there are holding up on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Israeli officials report more Iranian missiles striking residential buildings in southern Israel today, including apartments and offices. This comes a day after Iran hit a high-rise apartment building in Tel Aviv and a hospital in southern Israel. The White House says President Trump will decide over the next couple of weeks whether the U.S. will join the Israeli military operation designed to take out Tehran's nuclear threat. This is day 8 of fighting between Israel and Iran. In Geneva, European foreign ministers are meeting with Iran's foreign minister in the latest effort to convince Tehran to negotiate an end to its nuclear ambitions. NPR's Rob Schmitz has more.
Germany's Foreign Minister Johann Wadepool said Germany, alongside its European partners, is open to further discussions with Iran if there is a serious willingness from Tehran to provide assurances on its nuclear and missile programs. His comments came ahead of a meeting that he and the foreign ministers of France and the UK are holding with the Iranian foreign minister in Geneva. Wadepool said these assurances from the Iranian side should include a willingness to renounce enrichment of nuclear material that would lead to weaponization and would also include drawing down its missile program. Rob Schmitz, NPR News, Berlin.
This is NPR News. Some evangelical leaders are calling on President Trump to roll back planned cuts to HIV funding for countries in Africa. Blake Farmer with member station WPLN says those attending a recent concert in Nashville were urged to lobby Republican lawmakers. For
the
children
of the world. The draw was the music of Amy Grant and other Christian music artists. Their well-known songs packed the pews, but the message was less familiar, focused on President Trump's cuts to a program known as PEPFAR that provides antiviral drugs to treat HIV/AIDS across Africa. It's credited with saving 26 million lives, but has stalled along with many foreign aid programs. Russell Moore is the editor-in-chief of Christianity Today.
But we actually have the ability to address this in a way that doesn't divide us, but unites us.
Moore and others asked evangelical Christians to be open-minded and to encourage their Republican senators to do the same. For NPR News, I'm Blake Farmer in Nashville.
This year's NBA champion will be decided in Sunday night's Game 7. Last night in Indianapolis, the Indiana Pacers evened the league championship series at 3 games apiece after beating the Oklahoma City Thunder 108-91 in Game 6. The two teams will square off in Oklahoma City in the deciding Game 7. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from BritBox, committed to shaking up people's watch list with British TV, including new original series like Ludwig, starring Peep Show's David Mitchell. Streaming now at BritBox.com/NPR. From Your Part-Time Controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting. YPTC.com/NPR. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. The Trump administration shut down a program last month that was helping thousands of veterans avoid foreclosure. Democrats and Republicans in Congress are asking the VA about what will happen to the vets who may now lose their homes. NPR's Chris Arnold and Quill Lawrence have been talking to some of those veterans.
Right now, there are about 80,000 vets in the USA behind on their mortgages and heading toward foreclosure, according to industry data. And many of them are angry about what the VA just did.
John Henry served during the first Gulf War in an anti-chemical warfare unit. Now he lives in Kansas City. He fell behind on his mortgage after losing his job managing a manufacturing plant.
my social media posts have not been nice to the director of the Veterans Affairs and has not been nice to Trump. And I voted for the guy.
Henry was trying to get into a VA program that in just the past year has helped more than 33,000 vets and troops who got behind on their loans by giving them a new affordable mortgage.
Most American homeowners have mortgages backed by the government in one way or another, and they all have pretty good emergency options for people who fall behind. But that's not true anymore for veterans with loans backed by the VA. That's because out of fear of the potential cost, the Trump administration abruptly shut down that safety net for VA loans before replacing it with anything else.
That's what bothers me, you know, and it's like, damn, you keep talking big about how you're doing all this for the veterans and doing this for the veterans, but you just turned your back on 80,000 vets that have VA loans.
NPR has heard from more than 50 vets around the country in recent weeks. Mason Rial is a former Navy sonar technician in Lake Wales, Florida.
I'm constantly terrified every day that some giant moving truck or some people are just going to show up on the front door and kick us out and start throwing all of our stuff out of the house.
Matthew Kelly is a retired Navy special operations diver in San Antonio, Texas.
It's infuriating and it's devastating. I thought it was resolved.
And some vets have told their senators how they feel. When VA Secretary Doug Collins most recently appeared before a Senate committee, he heard about it, and not just from Democrats.
I was just with a press conference back home.
Republican Senator Bill Cassidy of Louisiana said he's getting asked about the VA killing this program. It's called VASP.
They asked me about the VA Servicing Purchase Program, or VASP.
Yeah, the VASP program is something that we do not need to be in, so we on May 1st did end that part.
Some Republicans think VASP put too much taxpayer money at risk because the VA buys up the troubled loans and holds them on its own books. The VA secretary said he's hoping Congress passes legislation to replace VASP with something else.
But Democrats slammed the VA for basically ripping up the safety net without anything there to replace it. Even Arkansas Republican John Bozeman followed up with Collins on that point. It takes time to pass legislation and for the VA to stand up a new program, and there are vets in danger of foreclosure right now.
How does the VA plan to help veterans at risk of foreclosure for those individuals that are caught up in that now? It makes it really difficult.
Difficult for veterans like Matt Kelly, the Navy diver we heard from earlier. Kelly suffered a brain injury on a dive. He still gets headaches. And a few years ago, he had to stop working for a while.
I was having terrible migraines. I thought I needed time to deal with my medical stuff.
Kelly's mortgage company allowed him to pause payments and told him he'd have an affordable way to catch up. And VASP would have done that, but then the VA shut it down.
Kelly and his wife have three young kids. When we first spoke to him, he'd been up most of the night trying to figure out what to do.
It's like I shake, you know, like uncontrollably. That's what my wife woke me up and said. I was shaking and she woke me up. But I'm more right now pissed off and angry.
Then, after NPR reached out to Kelly's mortgage company and the VA, the president of the company, it's called LoanCare, called us back and said that in Kelly's case, they will eat the cost and give him a new low-interest loan.
But that's not happening for the thousands of other vets who are still behind on their loans. Kelly says he's still worried about them.
It's the responsibility of the VA. They announced this program, then they canceled the program, and they're leaving veterans hanging. It's the responsibility of the VA. Their mission to protect veterans and to care for veterans is not being fulfilled.
Some in Congress asked the VA to pause foreclosures until it comes up with a fix. A VA spokesman wouldn't comment on that, but said, quote, the VA has a longstanding history of exploring options for veterans to retain their homes.
Congress is working on a replacement for the VA home loan safety net, but it's not clear how long that will take or how many veterans might lose their homes in the meantime. Chris Arnold
and Quill Lawrence, NPR News.
Inflation has pumped up food prices at the grocery store and in restaurants. So we spoke to restaurant owners across the country who sell regional classics to see how they're doing.
We're starting in Texas. Leonard Botello is the owner and pit master of Truth Barbecue in Houston.
Beef is the hardest for us because that's like our gift and our curse. That's what we sell the most of, and that's what we make the least of.
When Botello first opened a decade ago, he was selling brisket for $17 a pound. Now it's going for more than twice that, $36 or $37 a pound, and he still feels like he's underselling it.
The brisket should honestly be at $45 a pound.
Even though menu prices have climbed since the pandemic, Patello says he takes a lot less money home.
It's very discouraging because then you're working for pennies on the dollar because our margins are so slim.
Thank you. Number 266.
In New York City, Jimmy Stafakis owns the five Manhattan locations of Bagel Market. Before the pandemic, he sold a bacon, egg, and cheese bagel for around $5.25. That breakfast bagel can now run customers, wait for it, up to $9.25.
The cost of goods has gone through the roof. At one point, a couple months ago, we were paying $220 for a case of eggs.
Stafakis says every aspect of running his business has gone up, from rent to electricity to insurance.
We used to be able to run stores at, say, 20% profit. Now we're hoping for 12.
It's not much different in San Diego, the home of the California burrito with carne asada, cheese, guacamole, pico de gallo, salsa, and French fries all wrapped up in a tortilla. John Rudolph owns Mike's Taco Club.
Sometimes I think, man, maybe it's better to work for a large corporation and you just have fewer stresses.
Before the pandemic, his California burrito cost under $11. Now it's $14.99, and he says other places charge as much as $20.
Man, that just seems kind of outrageous.
Rudolph says he feels fortunate owning a business with a great staff, but it's been increasingly difficult to keep up with the cost of doing business.
You're kind of on an escalator of expenses going up. There's really no end in sight.
It's a challenge many restaurant owners across the country are facing and many consumers are feeling every time they go out for a bite. This is NPR News.
Some of the new picks to serve on the CDC Vaccine Advisory Board have ties to pharma, and that's raising ethical concerns. That's next time on Here and Now.
The latest in national politics, inspiring podcasts, and a report from your local school board meeting last week. You can hear it all in one place with the NPR app. Download it today.
Good morning, I'm Layla Faldin, and I love ice cream, but I'm not sure I love it enough for this. At the midpoint of the Appalachian Trail, a general store has a half-gallon challenge for anyone making the full 2,000-mile hike. The AP talked to some hikers who tried it. Pure misery, said one. Someone wrote in the store's notebook, it was very fun for the first 15 minutes. Now I and my family want to die. I think I'll stick with a pint minus the 2,000 miles. It's morning edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. kauffman.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Layla Faldin. Good morning. What did the Department of Government Efficiency actually accomplish under Elon Musk? One of Musk's former Doge workers is going public with his account. From the Planet Money podcast, NPR's Bobby Allen brings us his story of the first phase of the Trump administration's efforts to cut spending.
Sahil Lavingia joined Doge as a techie idealist. He's a software engineer who wanted to improve government systems from the inside. He's not a huge Donald Trump fan, but admired Elon Musk. He knew joining Doge wouldn't go over well with everyone.
Obviously, like, a lot of my family would not be excited about it. Most of my friends would be like, what the hell are you doing? But hopefully I could go back and be like, well, this is what the hell I did. I shipped this code. It made people's lives better. And hopefully they wouldn't stop talking to me.
After about 2 months assigned to the Department of Veterans Affairs, he says he was able to cut some contracts and he worked on the VA's internal chatbot. But when it came to fighting fraud, a stated mission of Doge, he often fell short. Take, for instance, a call he got one day from one of Musk's deputies.
He asked us to look into this person who may be receiving disability payments even though they're 137.
Lavingia thought, okay, that doesn't sound right. He made a few calls, had a longtime VA career employee dig into it.
He comes back to us and says, hey, you know, this guy's in our database, he's 75.
When he passes along to Musk's deputies, he never heard back. But he says the confusion was over two government computer systems miscommunicating, not egregious fraud.
I know what happened, right? Like, as a software engineer who's worked on software and seen data, like, you know, some software languages, like, there was a null value that then got set to 1900 or something.
Lavingia was hoping for more easy wins to show Doge was really making a difference, like obvious examples of government bloat or fraud that could be quickly rooted out. One of his big takeaways is that while government is not perfect, there are already many checks in place to combat waste and abuse.
I mean, I really believe that, like, we hoped there would be more fraud. That, like, I think we underrated how many checks there exist when you pay somebody. I think actually there is a check somewhere in the system, and that check proves, you know, make sure that they're alive, make sure that they're, you know, they've gone to a doctor's appointment in the last 3 months.
Last month, Lavingia talked about his Doge work to the publication Fast Company. He told the magazine that government wasn't as inefficient as he had expected. He thought he was fulfilling Musk's push for Doge to be transparent.
And he would say transparency was the goal, maximally transparent was the goal. And then when I tried, I got canned.
The Trump administration didn't respond to a question about his termination. Later in May, Musk left Doge too, along with some of his top advisors. Doge staffers are still spread out across federal agencies working as in-house consultants, and they're collecting and combining massive amounts of sensitive data and helping to lead efforts to fire workers and cancel contracts. But its work is far less high profile now that Musk isn't in charge. Lavingia, for one, thinks Musk's exit means Doge will eventually just be folded into other cost-cutting efforts in the Trump administration.
I don't think Trump is going to just cancel Doge, but I think it will sort of fizzle out, you know, ends up with a whimper, not a bang sort of thing.
The White House says cutting waste, fraud, and abuse will continue to be a goal of the administration, but in a statement affirming this mission, it left out one word, Doge. Bobby Allen, NPR News.
Support for Planet Money comes from Capital One with the Capital One Saver Card. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com.
This is NPR News.
Thank you.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. The U.S. needs more air traffic controllers. Thousands of them. The crash in January outside of Washington, D.C. of a jet and a military helicopter and the communications outages at Newark's airport brought more attention to the problem. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy has promised to supercharge the hiring process, but training and certifying those controllers can take years. NPR's Joel Rose visited one school that's trying to get them on the job faster.
Long before they're allowed to talk to real pilots, air traffic control students start with simulators, where giant video screens stand in for the windows of an airport control tower.
Dart 68 Heavy Academy Tower, make sure to runway 28 right, runway 28 right, clear to land.
20-year-old Haley Williamson calmly guides a virtual plane for a landing. This simulator is set up to mimic the airport in Oklahoma City, where the Federal Aviation Administration's academy trains future air traffic controllers. But this is not the academy. It's more than 1,000 miles away in Daytona Beach, Florida, on the campus of Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University, where students can train on a range of simulators just like the ones the FAA uses. Suddenly, two circles on the radar scope flash red, and the computer starts beeping. That's the collision avoidance system, as Williamson explains.
That signal is like, hey, they might collide. You need to do something about it. And when you're doing your evaluations, you hate to hear that sound because that's the sound of Professor Rankinen deducting points off of your evaluation. So we try not to hear that sound as much as possible.
The FAA needs all the air traffic controllers it can get. The U.S. is more than 3,000 certified controllers short of full staffing, and the agency's academy in Oklahoma City has limited capacity. This is where colleges and technical schools come in. Embry-Riddle is one of a half dozen schools that now offer an accelerated training program that mirrors the classes at the FAA Academy.
That shortens that hiring process from years down to weeks or months.
Michael McCormick worked at the FAA for over 30 years. Now he runs the air traffic management program at Embry-Riddle. Until recently, he says it would take 1 to 2 years for Embry-Riddle graduates to get hired as controllers because they would have to spend a few months at the FAA Academy first and then wait for their medical and background checks. But these accelerated programs allow students to start those checks before graduation. And if they pass their exams, they can skip the academy altogether.
Now we can start that process while they're a student early in their academic career. They can then be directly hired to an air traffic control facility.
The first class of 4 students graduated from Embry-Riddle's accelerated training program last month, including Kira Hansen from Bloomington, Indiana. Hansen says she knew absolutely nothing about air traffic control before she took an aptitude test that suggested she would be good at it.
I was like a lot of people and thought it was the people at the airport with the glow sticks that helped move the plane. So I looked it up and I was like, oh, this is like kind of cool.
The more Hansen learned about the job, the more she liked it. She knows there is a shortage of air traffic controllers and that at many facilities they are forced to work mandatory overtime and 6-day weeks. But Hansen isn't worried.
I'm open to the challenge. You know, I don't mind doing the work or the overtime. As someone just getting out of college, it's like, what else do I have going on? You know, working 6 days a week doesn't freak me out because I don't really know what I'd be missing.
These aspiring controllers don't seem intimidated by the stresses of the job either. On the contrary, Haley Williamson says she's impressed by how relaxed the staff seem at the facilities she's visited.
You expect that when you walk in that the stress level is going to be high, and you walk in and these controllers are having conversations and laughing and controlling these airplanes. Once you get into it and you see the community of people that you have, it's really not as stressful as I think a lot of people make it out to be.
This accelerated program means students like Williamson can hopefully join the community of air traffic controllers a year early. That alone won't end the shortage, but it's better than arriving late. Joel Rose, NPR News, Daytona Beach, Florida.
At the FIFA Club World Cup here in the U.S. this week, British soccer player Joe Bellingham made his debut for Borussia Dortmund. By joining the German club, he's following in the footsteps of his big brother Jude.
Bellingham has it now, and Bellingham has scored brilliantly.
That's Jude finding the net for Dortmund in 2021, as heard on CBS Sports. Why do we see so many sets of siblings succeeding at the highest level of sport, like Jason and Travis Kelce, both Super Bowl winners for different teams?
We did some research of people that had made it to the very top, and they talked very heavily and very positively about the role they perceived their siblings to have in their success.
That's Robin Taylor, a professor at the School of Health and Human Performance at Dublin City University. He studied the effect of siblings on talent development in elite sport.
There are a number of different mechanisms that help support siblings to develop skill sets. And one is rivalry, so competitive stuff, you know, being in the garden, doing 1v1s, using the Bellingham example, and wanting to kick each other and challenge each other, etc.
NBA superstar Steph Curry told BasketballNews.com that's how it was for him growing up with his younger brother, fellow pro Seth Curry.
There's times we're in the backyard, we're acting like we're NBA players and like shooting fake game winners.
It clearly prepared him for moments like these.
Steph, for the win. Yes, sir! His eighth career game winner!
That's Curry leading his Golden State Warriors past the Houston Rockets in an NBA game back in 2022.
Robin Taylor also found that having a supportive sibling helps.
There's a lot of empathy or emotional interpersonal skills that siblings were demonstrating between each other to help the other person maybe overcome something.
That's exactly what we see with these two.
That's it. And the sisters create history.
Venus and Serena Williams won their third Olympic gold medal in women's tennis doubles in London in 2012. They've often talked about the support they receive from one another. Here's Serena Williams speaking with NPR in 2009.
Being kind of the little sister and the one that wasn't as strong and wasn't as good yet gave me encouragement and gave me the fight that I have in my game.
Okay, Layla, tell the truth. How many of these athletes did you actually know?
And I knew the Williams sisters.
Okay, and the sports, did you actually know what sports
we
were discussing?
I knew tennis. No, I knew tennis. Okay. And I know the Kelce brothers because of Taylor Swift shade.
Okay, fair. Okay, fair.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Our theme music was inspired by BJ Lederman. I'm Layla Faldin.
And I'm Michelle Martin.